content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first story today, USA Swimming Has a Secret Weapon, Linear Algebra, by Jordana Sapelowitz. In the fall of 2014, Andrew Wilson took a front row seat in Ken Ono's number theory class at Emory University in Atlanta. Wilson was not only double majoring in applied math and physics, he was also a walk-on member of Emory's swim team. Ono took an interest in Wilson's ambitions. "We thought that, together, maybe we could use our interest in mathematics to help him improve as a swimmer," Ono says. Ono, who typically studies abstract patterns in numbers and special functions called modular forms, began collecting and analyzing acceleration data from Wilson and other Emory swimmers to identify and quantify their weaknesses. "It got to the point where I could just see what an athlete was doing without actually watching them swim," he says. Within 2 years, Wilson had won national collegiate championships. He would go on to earn a gold medal at the 2021 Tokyo Olympics. By then, Ono was at the University of Virginia, where he worked alongside Todd DeSorbo, the head coach for both UVA swimming and the U.S. Olympic women's swimming team. Ono will join the Olympic team staff in Paris later this summer as a technical consultant. "I feel like we're all in this together, trying to make something new," he says. Jordana Sapelowitz of Quanta spoke with Ono about how he has used mathematics to help swimmers make it to the Olympic stage. The interview has been condensed and edited for clarity. Jordana Sapelowitz, "So how successful has your program been?" Ken Ono, "The results speak for themselves. A bunch of our people went to the Olympics in 2021. At the most recent World Championships, every female American gold medalist in individual events was a UVA athlete. Kate Douglas showed up here at UVA a few years ago, swimming the 200-meter breaststroke in 2 minutes and 30 seconds. Now she's the American record holder, with a time of 2 minutes, 19.3 seconds. She just broke the U.S. Olympics trials all-time record, and she's a favorite to win the Olympics this year. 5 UVA athletes, including Kate, just became U.S. Olympians, one-fourth of the U.S. world's team. Gretchen Walsh won the 100-meter butterfly, setting the world record. Paige Maiden got second in the 400-meter freestyle, right after Katie Ledecky. Paige is now a 2-time Olympian." Sapelowitz, "What was your initial goal?" Ono, "If you take the swimming out of it, we have Newton's laws of motion. Those are the equations that we work with. We wanted to carefully understand the implications of Newton's laws applied to swimmers in the pool. How do we measure acceleration, deceleration, and drag? Those were the first questions that we had to answer in the development of our tools." Sapelowitz, "How did you get started?" Ono, "It began innocently enough with Saran wrap and accelerometers designed for shark tracking that I bought from marine technology outfits. We didn't know what we were doing. I needed to fasten these accelerometers to swimmers, so I got Saran wrap and wrapped these sensors around their waist super tight. Some swimmers were just too powerful, so the sensors never stayed inside the Saran wrap. So now I have these belts that my wife made that have a little pocket for the sensors." Sapelowitz, "It took time to get this experimental setup to work." Ono, "It was hard to even get data. Our protocols for waterproofing were funny. They looked like Boy Scout instructions. Wrap the accelerometer in tissue paper, burrito style. We discovered some of our sensors could fail. They were very sensitive to light, so we had to fashion little plastic UV covers to protect them. It wasn't that long ago that we were that amateur. We've come a long way since then. I record swims with high-definition video and with accelerometers and force paddles. I've also assembled a very large battery of tests that look nothing like swimming. I test how athletes swim when they get their kicks at different tempos. I test how flexible they are, how tired they get after certain tasks. I want to get a good sense of what their capabilities will be. During these swims and tests, I measure the force that is generated in three-dimensional space by the athlete's legs, by undulation at the hips, and by their hands. High-definition video generally captures only 24 screenshots per second. Each sensor gives me 512 force vectors per second. They can reveal things you'll never see in the video. Sapolowitz, like what? Oh no. One subtle thing that we picked up on very easily, and you wouldn't see it with your eyes, is how an athlete might change the execution of their kicks three strokes away from the wall, causing them to lose time. That's just one example. Using our data, we perform a very careful and serious analysis of each individual swimmer. We get a breakdown of the swim. My first test look for where you're decelerating for no good reason. Some athletes really struggle with their transitions, coming into and coming out of a wall. Or they might need to correct their head placement in a streamline, an underwater glide, where they're not actually swimming. At the Olympic and World Championship level, where races might come down to hundredths of a second, these things matter. Once we wipe out the sources of a deceleration, then we look at what the limbs are doing in motion. As you fatigue, how is your stroke falling apart? Are you maximizing the percentage of force you generate so that your body swims in the right direction? Sapolowitz, how do you extract this information from your data? Oh no, some of it is as simple as linear algebra. When an athlete takes a stroke, they're generating force that can be pointed downward, upward, to the right or to the left, or in the direction of the swim. We use linear algebra techniques to calculate the percentage in each of those directions. Would you believe that we've never measured anyone who was more than 60% efficient in the four strokes, freestyle, breaststroke, butterfly, and backstroke? It's basically impossible. In April, we had Paige Maiden wear force sensors, and we modeled the path of her hand as she took a stroke and recovered. We computed that in the first lap of her swim, 59.1% of the force her right hand generated was propelling her in the direction she wanted to go. That is awesome. But by lap 8, only 42.1% was propelling her forward. Not only was she getting more tired, but her execution was starting to fall apart. So using just these insights from linear algebra, we gave her some cues about how to swim the race differently. The next day on lap 8, she was close to 50%. 1 month later, she swam her personal best. Our paddles don't let you lie. We don't let you fool yourselves. Sapolowitz, and this math works the same for all four strokes? Oh no, I've never been able to get our force sensors to work for breaststroke. There's too much going on. I get data, but I can't make heads or tails of it. Sapolowitz, why is breaststroke harder to deal with? Oh no, I wish I could tell you. I mean, it's breaststroke. Your hands are doing much more in terms of in-sweep, out-sweep. That's a hard problem. But I don't know. Sapolowitz, you also use your data to make predictions and develop race strategies, right? Oh no, that's right. We can use all our data to build a digital twin of an athlete. Digital twins are mathematical models of complicated systems and processes, such as the spread of COVID or the migration of population of animals, things that vary over time. Except in my case, it really is a digital twin. It looks like an EKG going tick, 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 and it's developed based on the data I've captured about an athlete's movements. I can model how they will race under different conditions. Over the last 7 or 8 years, I've collected thousands of swims from more than 100 top athletes. So I can race your digital twin against the database, make adjustments, and assemble the optimal formula you should use for your race. How many kicks do you take off the dive? Where do you place your hands coming into a turn? How many breaths do you take, and in what pattern? It's curated per athlete, per inch. We can say, if you swim using this formula, you're going to do the 100-yard backstroke in under 48 seconds. These simulated races between digital twins might show a competitor 2 or 3 feet ahead of you at a particular point in time. But I don't want you to worry about that, because you'll see that on leg three, they're going to slow down and you'll catch up. If you watch the footage of NCAA races, you'll probably get a sense that the UVA athletes seem to have this extra swagger, like they cannot lose. And there is, of course, truth to that, because they are winning all the time. But one of the unexpected benefits of our work is, in their minds, they think, if I swim that formula, I will win the race. Sapelowitz, what challenges have you had to overcome while doing these analyses? Oh no, accelerometer data is very noisy. Accelerometers are very sensitive. So some of the mathematics that's deeply theoretical involves how you smooth the data to dampen out the noise. I need to know when a peak is meaningful. I have to be able to look at a stream of accelerometer data and say, this is where you're breathing to the right, but you lifted your head up a little too much. Or this is how much force you generated at the instant you moved off the wall before you started decelerating. I need that level of sensitivity. I need to have confidence that the numbers I get mean what I think they mean. Figuring out the correct method to smooth out this noisy data is probably the most sophisticated type of mathematics that we had to do. And that's very secret. Sapelowitz, what have you taken away from this experience? Oh no, we haven't discovered or invented any new math. We're not doing rocket science here. What I think this proves is that the attention to detail that comes from thinking analytically has merit. I want to find the stuff no one else has and use Newton's laws together with experimentation and some linear algebra to help craft the best performances for the athletes we work with. There are still coaches who don't take us seriously. My job is to help these athletes improve as swimmers and to get as many of them on the Olympic team as we can. I'm a pure mathematician by training. That can be rather lonely. So this is perhaps one time in my life where my training as a mathematical scientist seems to matter to a large group of people. It has been a dream ride. Next, the CrowdStrike failure was a warning, by Brian Klaus. Recently, crucial systems across the world collapsed, triggered by one mistake in a single company. The CrowdStrike outage hit banks, airlines, and healthcare systems. It may end up being the worst information technology disaster in history. It was not, however, an unforeseeable freak accident, or will it be the last of its kind? Instead, the devastation was the inevitable outcome of modern social systems that have been designed for hyper-connected optimization, not decentralized resilience. We have engineered a world in which tiny localized errors can cause a global crisis. This precarious state of affairs is by human design and can therefore be undone. But we are currently speeding toward much greater calamities than the CrowdStrike debacle. Throughout our advancement as a species, from building empires to building machines, social systems have evolved to be more connected and centralized. Eventually, an emperor or a king could make a decision in a far-flung palace, and it would soon affect the lives of potentially millions of people. By the Industrial Revolution, trade routes and supply lines had become global. Disaster in one region could upend economies far away. This connectivity and coordination produced unprecedented innovation and prosperity. It was efficient, but it also amplified social risk. In the 21st century, the combination of globalization and digitization has created a landscape characterized by the threat of catastrophic instantaneous risk. Globalization enables large efficiency gains, as with just-in-time manufacturing, where a product can be assembled from carefully managed links in the global supply chain. But those systems lack resilience. Every link must fit together perfectly. If the system falls apart, even one chain breaks. This fragility became obvious when one boat blocked the Suez Canal in 2021, causing enormous damage to the global economy. Similarly, digital connectivity has unlocked significant innovations, but it has also meant that much of the world's core operations rely on a tiny subset of companies and the software they develop. Until recently, most people had never heard of CrowdStrike. Now it's impossible to ignore how many of our most basic forms of social infrastructure are stacked on top of sometimes precarious bits of computer code. It should bewilder us all that the structures governing our lives were just fixed using a method only slightly more sophisticated than, "Have you tried turning it off and on again?" Centuries ago, the philosopher David Hume wrote that we can never be certain that the patterns of the past will remain the patterns of the future. As I argue in my book, Fluke, this is especially true in the 21st century. We are gambling more and more of our world on unstable, volatile systems. Worse, we're gambling with higher stakes in a time of social upheaval and structural change. Can we really trust our species to flawlessly govern unimaginably complex systems? Systems that we don't always fully understand, that can be brought down by a single screw-up? CrowdStrike worked like clockwork, until it suddenly didn't. And when you're facing catastrophic risk, close to perfection isn't good enough. Modern societies have discounted the cost of that risk because our current reward system are geared toward optimization over resilience. Politicians try to deliver short-term improvements, not long-term planning. Nobody gets reelected by investing in a rainy day fund. Even worse, for the few politicians who nonetheless focus on long-term planning, their opponents might be the ones who get credit for being prepared when the time comes to use the rainy day fund. Similarly, business leaders can be hired or fired based on quarterly results. Even though the modern quest for optimization has too often made resilience an afterthought, it is not inevitable that we continue down the risky path we're on. And making our systems more resilient doesn't require going back to a disconnected primitive world either. Instead, our complex interconnected societies simply demand that we sacrifice a bit of efficiency in order to allow a little extra slack. In the case of CrowdStrike, it's an unwise choice to have so much critical infrastructure riding on one company or one batch of digital code. Societies will be less vulnerable if social systems rely on a more diverse digital array of companies, if those companies are required to follow a more stringent testing for updates, and if critical infrastructure has more redundancy so that it can continue operating safely even when one component breaks. For the broader set of risks facing global society beyond digital ones, better regulation is essential to ensure fail-safes, backups, stress testing, and decoupling, so that a problem in one node of a system doesn't bring down everything else. The CrowdStrike debacle is a clear warning that the modern world is fragile by design. So far, we have decided to make ourselves vulnerable. That means we can decide differently, too. For our third story today, the small island where 500 people speak 9 different languages, by Michael Erard. On South Goulburn Island, a small forested isle off Australia's north coast, a settlement called Warui Community consists of 500 people who speak among themselves around 9 different languages. This is one of the last places in Australia and probably the world where so many indigenous languages exist together. There is the Mong language, but is also one called Beninji Kunwak, and another called Yolgu Matha, and Barara, Nejubana, and Naka, Kunbarong, Iwaji, Torres Strait Creole, and English. None of these languages except English is spoken by more than a few thousand people. Several, such as the Nyebana and the Mawang, are spoken by groups numbering in the hundreds. For those individuals to understand one another, one might expect South Goulburn to be an island of polyglots, or a place where residents have hashed out a pidgin to share, sort of like a linguistic stone soup. Rather, they just talk to one another in their own language or languages, which they can do because everyone else understands some or all of the language, but doesn't speak them. This arrangement, which linguists call receptive multilingualism, shows up all around the world. In some places, it's accidental. Many English-speaking Anglos who live in U.S. border states, for instance, can read and comprehend quite a bit of Spanish from being exposed to it. And countless immigrant children learn to speak the language of their host country while retaining the ability to understand their parents' languages. In other words, receptive multilingualism is a workaround for temporary situations. But at Warui Community, it plays a special role. Ruth Singer, a linguist at the Wellsprings of Linguistic Diversity Project of the Australian National University, realized this by chance and wrote about receptive multilingualism at Warui Community recently in the journal Language and Communication. In 2006, for one of her trips for fieldwork on South Goulburn, Singer and her husband had a Toyota truck shipped from Darwin by boat. Though the island's not very big, there aren't many cars, so having one is a social lubricant. Singer and her husband became friends with a local married couple, Nancy Nagmal Mingmag, and her husband Richard Danglangal, who had a boat and trailer, but no car. And when the two couples ended up going fishing and hunting and digging up turtle eggs on the beach, that's when Singer noticed that Nancy always spoke to Richard in Mawang, but Richard always replied in Yolngu Matha, even though Nancy also spoke fluent Yolngu Matha. Once I started to work on multilingualism and tuned my ear into how people were using different languages, Singer wrote in an email, I began to hear receptive multilingualism conversations all over Warui. Like between two men working on fixing a fence, or between two people at the shop. There are varieties of explanations for this, Singer says. In the case of her married friends, Richard didn't speak Muang because he wasn't originally from Warui Community. If he did so, it might be perceived as a challenge to rules that exclude outsiders from claiming certain rights. Also, Yolngu Matha has more speakers, and those speakers tend to be less multicultural than speakers of smaller languages. More broadly, people at Warui Community avoid simply switching to a shared language because there are social and personal costs of doing so. Some families insist that their children speak only their language, usually their father's. Languages are associated with particular pieces of land or territory on the island, and clans claim ownership of that land, so languages are also considered to be owned by clans. One can only speak the languages one has a right to speak, and breaking this restriction can be seen as a sign of hostility. Still, neither restriction applies to understanding a language, or as Nancy put it in an interview with Singer, to hearing it. Singer suspects that receptive multilingualism in Australia has been around for a long time. The phenomenon was noted by some of the earliest European settlers on the late 18th century expeditions into the Australian interior. Although our natives and strangers conversed on a par and understood each other perfectly, yet they spoke different dialects of the same language, one settler wrote in a journal. While Australia isn't the only place in the world where receptive multilingualism happens, one thing that makes it different in Warui is that those receptive skills have a status as real proficiencies. Where the academic foreign language field tends to see such skills as a language half learned, acquisition at Warui, a person can claim receptive skills in a language as part of their repertoire. The Anglos in Texas aren't likely to put understand Spanish on a job resume, while the immigrant children might be embarrassed to say they can't speak their parents' languages. Another difference is that people at Warui Community don't see receptive skills as a path to spoken abilities. Singer's friend Richard Danglango, for example, has lived most of his life with speakers of Hmong, which he understands very well, but no one expects him to start speaking it. Receptive multilingualism has been institutionalized in some places. In Switzerland, a country with four official languages, Receptive multilingualism has been built into the educational system, such that children learn a local language, a second national language, and English from an early age. In principle, this should allow everyone to understand everyone else. But a 2009 study showed considerable monolingualism among Swiss citizens. Italian speakers tended to be the most multilingual, and French speakers the least. Moreover, each group of speakers possessed strong negative attitudes about the others. Just as in Warui communities, social factors and ideas about language shape the life of many languages in places like Switzerland. But even someone in Switzerland might consider the status of understanding without speaking in Australia to be no big deal, given that many people in Europe tend to have related languages in their repertoire. Think Romance, Germanic, and Slavic languages. This allows them to draw on cognate vocabulary and grammatical structures for passive understanding. The languages from Warui community, by contrast, come from six different language families and aren't mutually intelligible. So those clusters of receptive skills amount to something quite sophisticated. Not enough is known about receptive multilingualism to know how many languages someone could understand but not speak. Whether in Switzerland or at Warui community, one advantage of receptive multilingualism is that people can express who they are and where they're from without forcing other people to be that thing too. According to Singer, this creates a social stability at Warui community because all the groups feel comfortable and confident with their identities. One option for keeping the linguistic peace in other parts of the world is for everyone to opt into speaking a language they all share, perhaps even a lingua franca. This is called accommodation, which at its core is about reducing differences among people. But in some places in the world, accommodation is dispreferred, even unthinkable. In the case of Warui community, Singer notes that people who stake a claim to the community would be unwilling to speak another language. And that's one lesson to be learned from respective multilingualism at Warui community. Small indigenous groups are surprisingly complex, socially and linguistically, and receptive multilingualism is both engine and consequence of that complexity. It may be a key to ensuring the future of small languages as the population of speakers dwindles if more was understood about how to turn receptive abilities in a language into being able to speak it. If we understood receptive abilities better, we could design language teaching for these people, Singer says, which would make it easier for people who only understand their heritage language to start to speak it later on in life. I'm sorry if my pronunciation was not good on that last story. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.